And continuing the exploration around the Four Noble Truths. A statement of the Four Noble Truths in a simple fashion could simply be, there is suffering, or this is suffering in the more present active tense. There is suffering. Suffering arises with craving, the second noble truth. It's possible for craving to end, and with that ending of craving is the ending of suffering. And there is a path, the fourth noble truth. There is a way that we can engage in our lives to see this for ourselves, to see this ending of craving, the ending of suffering, to see that for ourselves. The Buddha also, in exploring these noble truths or ennobling truths, as Pam mentioned, that they shift our perspective on our experience from being something that's problematic to being something that uplifts us in terms of witnessing them, seeing them from this these perspectives that we're exploring. And so they shift our experience, these experiences of our reactivity, of greed, aversion, and delusion, from being something that just mires us or keeps us lost in the blizzard, as Luigi said last night, to being what helps us to, through the use of the tools of the Eightfold Path, those very same things that kind of mire us and swamp us and keep us lost in the blizzard become our way out. And so it is a shift of perspective that's offered with these Four Noble Truths that transforms our relationship, ennobles our minds, enables and ennobles our minds to see our experience in a different way that takes us in a direction that's different from being lost in the blizzard, and instead allows us to find ease and peace, freedom from that reactivity, freedom from that mire, that swamp. And the Buddha offered not only just these statements of the Four Noble Truths, but also expressed them with respect to actions that are, so there's a verb associated with each of these truths. So it's not simply there is suffering, but he says suffering should be understood. And so this is the action that we're asked to explore in relationship to suffering, understanding it. The second noble truth, a different way of phrasing this, rather than craving is the cause of suffering, and that's one way to frame it, but our usual way of understanding causality is that A causes B, and A is not B. Right? I mean, A causes B to happen, but with A is not B. But the way this second noble truth is expressed, the language is actually more along the lines of, with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. And so it's a co-arising conditioning that craving, that greed, that aversion, that delusion, it already is suffering. And it is that arising of craving that is the suffering. And so there's a way in which we can think of it as causal, because that is the kind of the linchpin, that greed, that aversion, that delusion, that craving is the linchpin. When that greed, aversion, delusion ends, the suffering ends. And so that's the second noble truth, with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. And the action that the Buddha encouraged us is that craving should be abandoned, craving should be let go of, craving should be released. That's the action associated with the second noble truth. The third noble truth, this freedom, that as the craving is abandoned, there is the release of that craving, the ending of that craving is the ending of suffering. That noble truth is meant to be realized. We are asked to recognize the freedom that comes with the release from craving. And the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path, the set of tools that support us actually in engaging with these first three noble truths. The path of understanding, of wise understanding, wise view, wise intention, the ethical section of the path, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, and the mental cultivation section of the path, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. These are tools, essentially, that support us to be able to understand suffering, to be able to abandon the craving, and to realize the ending of craving, to realize the ending of suffering. And so the fourth noble truth, the action associated with the Eightfold Path, is that it is meant to be cultivated. It is meant to be cultivated, developed, practiced. And so we can see that, you know, there's really an interweaving of these four truths. We don't just do the first without having some understanding of the path. And in fact, the instructions that we're offering here, the mindfulness instructions, the meditation instructions, are implicitly offering aspects of the path. When we offered the refuges and precepts last night, we were offering an aspect of the Eightfold Path in terms of the ethical conduct section, and understanding that kind of attitude or commitment to non-harming is important if we want to commit ourselves to non-suffering. If we want to move in the direction of not suffering, we need to recognize that not harming is a good way to begin. And then the meditation instructions that we're offering are bringing in aspects of wise effort and wise mindfulness and wise concentration and the understandings that the Buddha is pointing to, the perspective that makes wise mindfulness. Wise mindfulness is the perspective of wise view. This may be a simple way. Sometimes I like to just describe what wise view is in just the simplest of terms. And one of the ways to understand wise view is that we understand our experience as experience. That sounds like nothing. But it's a very different relationship to our experience than our usual approach, which is when something's arising, we take it personally. We feel like it's something personal about me, about separation from the world, about something I need to do, as opposed to being curious of, oh, this is what's arising. What's that like? What's it like to be a human being experiencing that? This is that shift that we're asked to explore in wise mindfulness, is this curiosity of, what is this experience? And that curiosity, what is this experience? Understanding experience as experience, that I would say is the crux or the nub of what it means to understand suffering. That action associated with the first noble truth. That we become curious about our experience. Curious about understanding what is happening. not in terms of how it relates to me, but how it is experienced. So this is that understanding. So with this teaching of these four actions, or these actions associated with each noble truth, and this is embedded within the first discourse the Buddha gave, the first discourse the Buddha is said to have given, I should say. hard to say what the actual first discourse was, but this discourse that is highlighted in the suttas as being the first discourse that the Buddha gave, it names these actions associated with each of these truths. Suffering should be understood. Craving, which is, we could say, the root around suffering, the arising of suffering, should be abandoned. This release from suffering should be realized, and the path should be cultivated. Along with that, he explored three different kind of levels of understanding or insight connected with each of these truths. And so I'll just explore this with respect to these first two noble truths this evening, this afternoon. So the first understanding that the Buddha pointed to with respect to suffering, with respect to dukkha, is this is dukkha. He said, it's important to understand when something is arising, if it is dukkha, to understand it as dukkha. This may, again, it may sound like nothing. It may sound like, you know, just like, what? What is that about? But again, it's kind of similar to this shift where I just pointed to of understanding experience as experience. So for instance, in the first few weeks of my beginning, my meditation practice, or my mindfulness practice, really, because I didn't start meditating for about 3 months after I started practicing mindfulness, but I was interested in exploring and understanding my mind, and in particular, understanding the anger. There's so much anger arising in my mind around a particular person, a situation. And so I got curious, and I had been given a book that had some suggestions about exploring experience. And I didn't understand a lot of what was in that book, I have to say. I mean, I was in the Peace Corps at the time. I didn't have a teacher to talk to. I had this book that somebody sent me, and just to read it, I think I got one real crucial bit of information about it, which was something along the lines of, well, when you're noticing something challenging arising, just know that it's arising. It's just along that same lines of just know that this is experience. And so with respect to anger, it's like, okay, when anger's arising, know that anger is arising. And so that was my first meditation practice. And in just reading that, I couldn't imagine how it would be valuable, because I thought, I mean, what my mind said is, well, what good is that going to do? Isn't it just going to make me more angry to notice when there's anger? But fortunately, in some ways, I had kind of hit bottom and I was willing to try anything. And this was offered. I trusted my friend who sent me the book. And my friend had said, you know, this has been helpful to me. And so I latched onto that little bit of like hope and gave it a try. And one of the things that happened as I began doing that and looking at that experience of anger was that I began to realize, so there was this little bit of a shift of kind of like, okay, well, what is it like to be angry? And the like very early in the process of doing this, it was like, wow, anger hurts. This is painful. And the subsequent weeks of exploring it helped me to see how I had missed that. that in my ordinary relationship with anger, I was connected more to thinking about the other person, how I was going to get back at them, how this anger was going to make them so miserable. And I was missing that it was making me miserable. And so that very first kind of turning to, oh, well, what is it like, this experience of anger as an experience, took me kind of out of all of the thoughts and machinations that were related to it into the direct experience. And the experience of that, I didn't frame it in this way at the time, but how my mind framed it is ouch. But what it realized is this is suffering. This state of mind is painful to this being. And so this is essentially this kind of understanding. This is suffering. This very first understanding the Buddha points to in the Four Noble Truths. This is suffering. It's an insight, actually. You know, it sounds simple, but it is actually wisdom at work in the mind that helps us to recognize, oh, this is suffering. Again, a kind of shift from how we have habitually related to these patterns, these habits, these experiences. And then the second understanding that the Buddha points to is, given that we see, oh, this is suffering, there's a kind of an urge or an inclination to want to understand it, to want to get a kind of more of a sense of, wow, this is a different perspective. Let me understand more about this experience of suffering. And so the second understanding the Buddha points to is, this suffering should be understood. Essentially, a kind of a turning towards, it's valuable to get curious about our suffering. It should be understood. This understanding that's pointed to in the First Noble Truth is not an intellectual understanding. It's not thinking about, why am I experiencing this? So for me in that situation, it's not about thinking about, why am I angry? I had done a lot of that. I thought I knew why I was angry. I thought I understood that from the intellectual perspective. And the big thing I thought I understood is that person never should have done that thing to me. And yet, this is asking it's a different approach. Understanding the direct experience of this arising experience. What is this experience of anger? What is this experience of reactivity? And so this is this kind of beginning. Suffering should be understood. We begin to get curious to bring perhaps some of the tools of the Eightfold Path to bear on our experience. These perspectives of this curiosity. Well, what is this experience? Understanding it is suffering. And getting understanding something about it. Seeing how it affects our minds, our bodies. So this shift involved with this insight is suffering should be understood. We shift from something along the lines of, well, why is this horrible thing happening to me? Instead, more to something like, wow, what is this experience? What is the humanness of this experience? That kind of framing too. What is the humanness of this experience helps to remind us that all humans experience these challenges. It helps also to make it a little less personal, not just about me. All of our struggles that arise are arising based on conditions. You know, I learned how to be angry. I learned how to be reactive in that way from my family, from my conditioning, from my culture, from how I was treated on the playground and reacted to that. All kinds of different threads coming in to how I learned to kind of navigate the world. I mean, our suffering, the way that we respond to the world, it's kind of like, you know, we learn how to respond to the world at a very young age when there's not necessarily a lot of wisdom and understanding about what's going on. And we're doing the best we can, given the conditions. We don't want to suffer. And so our bodies try to work their way of how can I navigate this? And the first thing we usually come upon is get rid of the unpleasant and hold on to the pleasant. That's like the most obvious strategy that helps us to feel better for just a little while. And we latch onto that and don't let that habit go. And this is human too. We all have done this. Without exception, we all have done this. And so the teaching of the Buddha is pointing us to, well, there's a different way. A different way than this habit of latching onto, pushing away. There's something else that can happen. And the first piece of that something else is beginning to understand what's happening inside of our experience. Understanding the suffering, understanding our minds. So this understanding is not an intellectual understanding, but rather, really, we could say this understanding, the core of this understanding is found in the teaching of wise mindfulness. We explore what does it mean to be aware of this experience? Just getting to know the experience directly. How does this feel in the body? How does this state of mind, this anger, this frustration, this confusion, how does that feel in the body? How does it affect the mind? What kind of thoughts does it create? Noticing how if we follow those thoughts, we get lost. And it's kind of like when we follow those thoughts, we start to see the amping up of a tendency. That was another thing I early on saw about the anger is when I hooked to the thoughts and kept thinking about them, the anger just got worse and worse, and the suffering got worse and worse. So we look at our experience, we explore with mindfulness, I like the analogy of being a naturalist in terms of the mindfulness practice, that there are different ways to observe nature and understand something about it. We might, go out in nature and think, oh, I want to understand that redwood tree, and well, let me cut it down and look at the rings and see how it's grown and, you know, how far apart are the rings and what do I know about, et cetera. We can essentially kind of dive in and, tear something apart to try to understand it. And that is one way of understanding something, but the approach in the wise mindfulness is more along the lines of a naturalist who goes out and wants to understand something more about the systems approach without destroying something, but more kind of steps back and is an observer, understanding something about the redwood tree by watching it grow, by seeing how animals take shelter in it, by seeing the small pine cones and what they do, just kind of observing the life cycle over time. And this kind of approach of understanding nature, the approach of the naturalist, requires time and requires patience. It requires that like willingness to observe something over and over again. Notice how it's connected with things around it. Notice how it changes. Very much the same kind of approach around observing our experience. A patient approach over time to be curious about what's happening. And so as we start to do this, as we start to look at what's going on in there, we begin to see, perhaps we begin to see, and with the help of the Buddha, we start to see there's some basic patterns underlying the ways in which we experience distress and suffering, these basic patterns of greed, of aversion, of delusion. Those are at the base of all of the forms of reactivity that we have. And so we may start to recognize that through this witnessing. And this is taking us into the second noble truth, because these deeper patterns, these roots, we could call them the roots of all of our reactivity, the greed, aversion, and delusion, these are all forms of craving. And we start to see that pretty much, or yes, every kind of suffering that we're experiencing, all the reactivity that we experience, all the ways in which our mind gets tied up in knots, it all includes this craving. And so this second noble truth, the first understanding that the Buddha points to, is this is the arising of suffering. With the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. And again, this is an insight, it's an understanding, kind of a deeper level of understanding that this is suffering, that this is suffering flavor is kind of like the ouch side of it. The understanding of the arising of craving is the arising of suffering is something about kind of the conditioned nature of suffering. We begin to see that it's not just random in our lives. We understand that there's a pattern at work, the pattern of greed, aversion, delusion. These patterns at work that lead or are the suffering, actually. As I said earlier, the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. And to me, that framing of that languaging of the second noble truth, and the Pali actually supports that framing. The word that's used in the Pali can be translated as arising. Craving arises with suffering, as opposed to craving causes suffering. So the word is actually more often used to mean arising. And so craving arises with, suffering arises with craving. And that maps my experience. When there is a sense of, oh, need something to happen, there's already a constriction, there's already pain. A wanting to push something away, there's already a tightness, already a pain. And so that kind of with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. Again, this is an understanding. As we understand the suffering, we start to see kind of this conditioned nature of suffering. That there are things happening in the present moment that may be at play with why the suffering is arising. Some of those external, some of them internal. Situations in the world meeting our conditioning, our habits, and sometimes what's happening serves almost like a trigger for the arising of greed and aversion and delusion. And so what's happening in the present moment kind of meets the conditioning from the past, and then how we are in the present moment. Is our mind kind of at ease, or many conditions can be at play here. I mean, we might be a little hungry, and that can be a condition that affects how we meet something. We might have just had a situation where somebody told us something very challenging, and then some other thing happens, and we don't have as much bandwidth to meet it. So there's a lot of kind of conditions that come into play with the way that suffering kind of comes into being, based on conditions. So the second noble truth, the first understanding, with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering, is really an understanding of the conditioned nature of our suffering. And then the Buddha points us to abandoning that craving. So that's the action associated with the second noble truth. This craving, he says, is to be abandoned. The craving is to be let go of. The craving is to be released. So a few things about this. The word abandon itself, we sometimes have a particular relationship with the word. I mean, the main way that my mind kind of thought about that word was, you know, it's like, well, you talk about abandoning children. You know, and that's not a good thing. You know, so that kind of abandoning is not something that's wholesome or healthy. And so given that my main relationship with the word abandon was something that was not a healthy thing, I needed to massage the word a little bit. I needed to understand what was being pointed to here. And so actually I went to the dictionary and looked up the definitions, multiple definitions of abandon. And two of them seem to be particularly relevant. One is something along the lines of leaving a place because of danger. So the phrase, abandon ship. You know, you don't abandon ship if it's safer to stay on the ship. You abandon ship when it's safer to leave the ship, because the ship is going down. So this kind of abandon is more along the lines of what is being pointed to. It's like, abandon ship, abandon craving. Craving is taking us down. Greed, aversion, delusion are taking us down. And so it's that form of the word. There's another definition that I found interesting and useful too. It was related to that we abandon something when we understand it is no longer valuable to us. And so something like we might, you know, if we're traveling somewhere and the car, you know, we're traveling somewhere in a car and the car breaks down, you know, it might be useful. I mean, depending on the situation, I hear if you're in the middle of Australia in the outback, you do not abandon the car and try to walk around to find your way out of the outback. I hear it's safer to stay with the car because you're more likely to be found. But in certain situations, you might abandon the car to go, you know, if you see a sign that says 3 miles to the nearest town, then you might abandon the car to walk away from it because it's not serving you to continue your journey. And so again, the sense of understanding when something is no longer of value. And this is a turning in our minds around understanding that greed, aversion, and delusion are not valuable. On the surface of it, saying it, we might understand that. You know, it's like, yeah, I mean, it seems like aversion might not be valuable, but in the experience of it, in the living of the having aversion, the mind state of aversion embeds with it. You need to get rid of this thing in order to be happy. And so that's a kind of a delusion embedded in the mind state of anger or aversion, that it thinks the only way to happiness is to get rid of the thing or the situation. That state of mind cannot understand or fathom there might be another way to happiness. And which the Buddha points to, that the abandoning of that aversion itself is a form of happiness. Now, it doesn't separate us necessarily from the situation, but it creates, as I mentioned last night, it creates a different relationship to a situation. So we may be experiencing kind of the more generalized suffering of the world, of the divisiveness in the world, and aversion around that divisiveness, aversion around the way that people are treating each other. And yet, and that aversion is telling you the only way to change the world is to buy into this aversion. You know, that's how things will change, is to follow through or act on this aversion and this anger and this hostility. But the approach of the Buddha suggesting is like, well, see what happens if you explore letting go, releasing that anger, that perspective of the only way to do anything is through this anger, begins to be seen as a delusion, and that there are alternative ways to act in the world. As that anger aversion falls away, there's the possibility of compassion, acting in the world to explore different ways to navigate through compassion rather than anger. And so this word abandon, you know, first of all, we need to understand it. It basically means we're abandoning something that's dangerous, and we're abandoning something that's not valuable to us. Another aspect of abandoning is that the word often we think of as meaning is something very active. We experience or understand that. It's like, well, when I abandon something, like both the analogies, abandoning the ship and abandoning a car that's no longer useful to us, you know, we're actively leaving them. There's another kind of abandoning, which is much more just natural. Not something that we're actively doing, but more that just happens. So, you know, imagine or remember, what was your favorite thing when you were 4 years old? Your very favorite thing. Is it still your favorite thing? I mean, it might be. But often, if you think of it in terms of a toy or something like that, you know, a toy of some kind, I had a teddy bear that was so well loved it lost its nose and its eyes, and you know, it didn't matter. And the you know, that kind of attachment to it is like, I have no idea what happened to that teddy bear. It just kind of faded away. It just was no longer needed. It just became unimportant. I didn't have to actively do a letting go of it. It just happened. And so there are different forms of abandoning in our practice itself. There are more active forms where we do actually take some action to let something go. And there are more, I don't know about the... Let's say receptive, more not so much active, but more just being with what is. And there is a way that this practice of understanding our experience, understanding what's happening in our experience, being with difficulty, at times we can see when there is an ability to be with it, with a curiosity, a sense of, oh, what is this? What is going on here? What is it like to be a human being experiencing this thing? When that kind of curiosity is there, then that process of understanding it can be the process of letting it go. What seems to happen is that as the mind understands the patterns, the habits, as the mind looks at them, hangs out with them, sometimes we get to see it just kind of falls apart in looking at it. Sometimes this happens. And then we can see that the understanding itself can be at times a form of the letting go. That we don't always have to take some active step to try to step away from something in abandoning. But instead it might be, oh, so here's the arising of aversion. rather than saying, oh, aversion needs to be abandoned. How do I step away from it? One way to step away from it, we could say we abandon our usual relationship to it of being caught by it. We abandon our familiar habit of engaging with it and following our thoughts and being hooked in it, and instead get curious about being with it. That's a form of abandoning our usual relationship to anger and just being with it. So we have unhooked from its tentacles, and then we can kind of see perhaps it begin to weaken, at times even fall apart for moments. And then it comes back, often it comes back, and we can see it again. And so this is one form of practice that the willingness to understand, the willingness to be with, to meet experience, can be a form of letting go. It may not be an experience of letting go that seems like it's happening quickly, but it is a way of meeting the experience that allows the mind to begin to release it because it's no longer hooked by it. Kind of like the analogy of having gears, you know, being kind of in a car when we have our foot on the gas pedal, the gears are engaged and the both gears are spinning, and when we're not mindful of a pattern such as anger, it's kind of like the thoughts are going and the emotion are going, and the thoughts are like one of the gears and the emotions are like another gear, and they're just fueling each other. And we are just traveling really fast with that, and it tends to wind it up. It gets it going more quickly. And the abandoning would be like disengaging the gears, letting the thoughts be, letting the feelings be, not following the thoughts, not getting hooked by the thoughts. And so in the analogy of the car, you know, we have our foot on the gas pedal, we're in, you know, fourth gear, we're going really fast down the freeway. Disengaging the gears means putting the car into neutral. The car doesn't stop when we do that. You know, it's not that we've put on the brake. There's still momentum in the car when we put the car into neutral. And it keeps going for a while, but it does slow down. The nature of it is to slow down. It loses its momentum because we're no longer fueling it. And similarly with our minds. When we put our minds into neutral, have this perspective of curiosity, it's like putting our minds into neutral. It allows these patterns to be seen without being encouraged, and they will naturally slow down because it is their nature to not be permanent. It is their nature to unwind when the conditions for their support fall away. So this is one way of abandoning that, putting into neutral, the being with experience. This is really, maybe we could call this the pure mindfulness approach to abandoning. Just exploring, what is this? What is this human experience? But, you know, just being with experience is not always possible. There are certain habits of mind, certain patterns in our mind that are so strong, so potent, that essentially when we try to turn and look at them, when we try to say, okay, well, that's happening, let me turn to look at that, it's like the power or the momentum of the habit is so much stronger than the practice that we're the amount of mindfulness that we have in that moment, that it gets swamped. It's like a tsunami to a little trickle of mindfulness. And so when we see that happening, when we see that the mindfulness is swamped, when there's a kind of an overwhelm in the mind, trying to be mindful of something just takes us right into the rabbit hole of it, pulls us right into it. That is not the time to try to be with it. So that's not the time to explore that more receptive side of abandoning, but it is time to look at some more active tools of letting go. And this is more like stepping aside or allowing the mind to attend to other things. So this is a general tool, whether for physical discomfort, where the mind is reactive and overwhelmed by physical discomfort, or mental reactivity. There's some basic kind of supports for helping us when we feel overwhelmed, either by a physical pain and the reactivity to a physical pain, or a mental pain, a mental experience that is just keeps pulling us in. So the first thing we need to have is a real honesty of, yes, this is a potent pattern. And so that's acknowledging, yes, this is dukkha. We are using that first understanding of the First Noble Truth. This is dukkha. And right now, we have to say, this is not the time to try to understand this dukkha. This is the time to set it aside, to abandon even attempting to be mindful of it. And so, this is a skill that we need to learn. When are we overwhelmed? When is the mind not capable of meeting that particular experience? So some tools for this. Often when there's something challenging, whether a physical pain or an emotional pain, it's like our mind is kind of magnetized to it, or it's like it's the only thing that's existing. It's like, it's this piece of the world and we've got our heads immersed in it. So that is all we're seeing. It feels as if it's the only thing that's happening in our experience. So pain can be that way. Mental reactivity can be that way. And so one of the first things to explore might be, if it feels overwhelming, if you can't be with it, if it's not that you can say, okay, well, this is the experience, this is what it's like to be feeling this pain right now, then the kind of one approach might be just as simple as reminding yourself that this is not the only thing that's happening in your present moment experience. So this pain is not the only thing that's happening. This depression, this anger, this frustration, it's not the only thing that's happening. At one point, I was on retreat in Burma practicing with Sayadaw Utejaniya, and I was experiencing a low-grade depression that was there a lot of the time, present quite a bit of the time. And one of the tools I began using was just reminding myself, because the mind kind of got stuck to it. It's kind of like it's like a magnet. It's like, oh yeah, there's that depression. And almost in the habit of practicing with something, it can be that too. It's like, oh yeah, here's the depression. I should be looking at this. But then I'd find myself pulled into the depression. And so just as a kind of a reminder, it's like, well, yeah, that depression is here. And seeing is happening. And I'm walking. The body is moving through space. And there's the physicality of the body. And then there's hearing too. And so kind of almost like taking inventory of the other senses. Seeing, hearing, physicality of the body moving through space. Oh, and there's the depression. And seeing is happening. And hearing is, oh, there's the depression. So not necessarily having to like say it's, having to step aside from it entirely, but really just, it's almost like give yourself a bigger container. Remind yourself that there's other things happening. That can help to diminish the power of the magnetic pull of that difficult experience. So kind of opening the container a little bit. And yet, sometimes the pull of the difficult thing is so strong that it needs to be a little more active than even that. We may need to actively kind of say, yeah, cannot pay attention to this. I called this my not now practice. Around the anger, there were many years of working with anger for me, and at times the anger was strong enough that I saw that it wasn't helpful to try to be mindful of it. And this seemed to a lot of the times happen when I was taking a walk, that the anger would kind of come to the fore and I would be charging off into the thoughts about whatever, the person that I was angry with. And as I noticed it, it's like, okay, yep, there it is. And I had gotten enough experience with this particular situation to see, yeah, it's not the time to try to be mindful of this experience. So I'm going to put my attention on something else. And for me at that point, it was relatively easy to pick something, a very obvious neutral experience that had a lot of kind of obviousness of contact. And for me, it was the contact of feet on the ground. Just like stepping, stepping, stepping. So there was a kind of the acknowledgement of the difficulty, a recognition that it was not the time to try to work with it, and a turning the attention to something else without repressing, without pushing away the difficulty. And so it's kind of like a stepping aside. It really almost felt like a bowing to that state. It's like, I see you. Yep. Yeah. Not now. And I even almost would say to it, well, you can take a walk with me, but I'm going to put my attention on my feet right now. So there's a kind of an acknowledgement of it, not a dismissal of it, not a denial of it. It was almost an honoring. Yes, I see you. I see you're powerful. I see you actually want to be seen, and now I'm not able to do it. And so I will get back to you, but right now I'm going to put my attention on my feet. And so it was a real turning away, a directing of the attention away from that state. And I find it's useful to pick something neutral in shifting the attention away. Playing with something. For me, it's often said that with anger, the kind of the counterpoint or the kind of skillful means to step aside from it is cultivating loving kindness. And that can be, I think it maybe if the anger were weaker, it might have been a strategy that would have worked for me. But the anger was strong enough that when I would try to, okay, well, may the person I'm so angry with be happy. It's like there was no way the mind was going there. May I be happy? Well, that's a little closer, but still, the mind was like, you are just denying what's going on here. There's a problem here. And so that kind of shift to metta didn't work in my mind when the anger was really strong. And so this shifting to something neutral, that pattern of anger was more willing to be set aside. It didn't feel like it was being denied. It was willing to say, okay, yeah, I'll let you do that. It wouldn't necessarily let me turn to metta. And so this shifting to some kind of neutral experience or some kind of clear experience where you just keep your attention on that. And it's helpful if that's something that's kind of dynamic. In that case, it was like, footstep, footstep, every footstep. So it was a changing foot every time. There are many tools like this, and I don't have time to describe them now, but if this is of interest to you in the group meetings, you could check in about what are some other tools. And it can be helpful to find your own almost go-to strategy for when things get really hard, to have something where you can let your attention rest. We might think the breath would be a place of that, and it can be at times. But if there's an emotional reactivity going on, like the breath might be useful if there's a pain in the body, maybe in I don't know, in your knee or your hands or something, you know, someplace apart from the area of the breath, that the turning to the breath might be a kind of a relief. Maybe we can breathe with the experience of the pain there. But often with a strong emotional reactivity, the experience of the emotion is often felt in the area of the torso, in the area where the breath is felt. And so when we try to turn to the breath when we're experiencing a strong emotional reactivity, sometimes it just reminds us of the feelings, because the feelings in this area are so bound up with that emotion. And so it can be helpful if you can use the breath. Sometimes that's great, but it can also be helpful to find something outside of the breath for some really, really challenging times. And that for me, it was often using my feet when I was walking. So it's time to end. We need to end. I'll just say the final piece for both of these two, the third insight, the third understanding that the Buddha pointed to is the suffering has been understood and craving has been abandoned. And both of these actually are very similar. Because when suffering is fully understood, it's like what I described earlier, that when we really understand what's going on in there, the mind starts to let it go. And so that full understanding is the release, is the abandoning of the craving. When craving has been abandoned, there's a touching into that sense of possibility, of peace, of freedom, a whole different relationship to the world that is hard to fathom from our usual perspective. And it takes some trust to step into the path, to be willing to understand and release the craving. Because it is so fundamentally different. This peace that is not simply chill, but much more active, much more engaged, able to meet both the sorrows and the delights of the world and respond. That's that freedom. So let's just sit for a moment.